Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, I think we're live. Oh, yes, we are live. Good afternoon, and welcome to Personal Transformation. My name is Stuart Thompson. I am a survivor of substance abuse, or CSA. Here I am, 201 number podcast, and we are talking with Victor today. Just to let you know that these are really, really strange times right now. There's so much going on in the world, so much crap going on. And, you know, before I start this podcast with my guest, if you haven't taken self-care for yourself today, I would suggest you do that. Go for a walk, listen to some music. Obviously, if you're, going to be wanting to be in air conditioning, or if you're in some parts of Central Ontario, we're dealing with major heat as well. Not quite as bad as BC, but take care of yourself today, folks. Without further ado, my guest, Victor. How are you today, Victor?
I'm doing well. And Stuart, thank you for the opportunity for being here today. I really appreciate this opportunity to share my story and hopefully educate your audience.
Thank you for having me here. This is awesome though, because I've been kind of wanting to do this. I haven't had many men guests on for a while. So I'm really happy to have you here, talking about your experiences with the CSA and other experiences which you're going to talk about through our time today. So I'm just going to get right to it because time is also short and sweet. And let's talk your story.
I'll give you the Coles high-level version of you know, most of my trauma as a child growing up. So my first childhood memories are also my first traumatic memories, and that is as a four-year-old little boy. This is back in the mid-70s. My parents had like a little barbecue that would sit on the ground, and so they lived up the coal and whatnot. So I was watching the barbecue and the flames dance in the atmosphere, and my older brother was riding his bicycle up and down the driveway, and I guess getting out and behind. At what point I got pushed? Well, to me, I mean, from my perspective, I was pushed into the fire. Burns my hands, chest, face. Don't remember very much after that. Remember waking up in the hospital, freaked out in the hospital. I remember they stayed me again, and then when I got home, that's when I remember coming to. And then that was also when my parents, or well, mother at the time, basically said that I scared her and that she needed to teach me a lesson. And proceeded to physically abuse me because I scared her, and she told me that I fell into the fire to the black hole. After that, I came home, and then he pretty much said the same thing. I interrupted his work day. He came home, because he was told it was an emergency, and I scared my mom, and I scared him, and so I had to be taught a lesson. So, the physical abuse happened, and then I was locked up in for several hours, and that's where I met my first two alternate identities. And now, before I continue on, I just want to let you know I have a diagnosis of severe complex PTSD, dissociative identity disorder, or TID, another fancy term for alternate personalities, borderline personality disorder, and early childhood developmental trauma. You fast forward 6 years to when I was 10, that was the summer. Was the first summer that I attempted my first suicide attempt. It was basically June, July, August. I basically tried to commit suicide. 3 times, 10-year-old boy. The second attempt was actually successful. I managed to drown myself in the pool. And someone, passerby, just happened to come by and revive me. And then by the time I was 13, I was assaulted by police because of the neighborhood I lived in and because of the people that I associated with or their families associated with. I grew up in a rough neighborhood. And then at 16, my mom pulled a knife on me, six-inch blade, pressed up against my stomach and told me she was going to gut me like a pig. So that night I went out and attempted my fourth suicide attempt. And then when I was 18 again, I tried one more time. And so throughout all those issues, I knew that by the time when I was 18, I knew I had to do something. Something had to change. And in my family dynamic at the time, I was given a free ride at university, and I actually walked away from it because I don't think I would have survived staying at home and going to university. I would have been a sixth attempt in there somewhere, or either that, or my mom would have probably terminated my life, either or. But and so I buried everything for almost 5 years, and I'll have to say that tactically, that's something that do. If you have trauma, deal with it. Do not bury it, because all it does is it amplifies over time. And so in 2014, I had a mental breakdown. I had a depressive episode, and I ended up being awake for 7 days straight. And at that point, you used pharmaceuticals and alcohol to try to get some sleep. Didn't work. I woke up an hour later, stone cold sober. And at that point, I realized I need help. So I remember the doctor at the drop-in clinic that I went to. He said, he said something about therapy or therapist. And I remember, I remember that word. So I'll Google it. And so that was my introduction to the mental health business in Ontario, because I didn't know how to enter the and because at the time I was in transit between two different my cat just threw up on my bed, so
right.
Kind of,
yeah,
why I turned around. So I ended up Googling therapist and started reading up on therapy. I didn't know I was mentally ill at the time. I didn't even know my past for the most part, because I did due diligence and I buried everything as deep as I could. And it was one of those things where memories to forget, memories that are forgotten, but didn't work out that way. They came back and hit me in the rear, and I ended up a therapist, going through when I met with the therapist first of all, and she's my ex-therapist, I met with her first of all. It was touch and go, because I had a lot of anger issues. I had a lot of different issues going on, and so it was a rough start. But once we got past that, we had what I thought was a good working relationship. Second year became kind of interesting because job losses. I couldn't afford to pay out of pocket. She recommended me to my current therapist, Dr. Bill, who was across the hall from her. He's been involved since 2015. No one, including myself or Dr. Bill or my therapist, no one was prepared for what was going to come to me, the tsunami of trauma, let alone did anyone know that I had DID at that point. And so I was institutionalized. I had, I had all kinds of different opportunities or privileges, I guess, from the mental health sector to correct my behavior, if you want to call it that. And so, long story short, in 2015, that's when it was documented that I had DID. Emails were starting to come out from my email account without my knowledge, from my different identities. Some of them seem to be technology savvy and know how to get into my phone, know how to get into my email account. So they were emailed to my circle of care at the time, not just my therapist, but to my circle of care. And And then I had an eye procedure done in 2016 where they burnt something off my eyelid, which took me right back to my first traumatic experience, at which point I dissociated in the evening, left voicemail messages on my ex-therapist. One was of a childlike state, and the other one was one of my demons. I refer to him as Harris. He's been with me since I was 4 or 5 years. And so anyways, he left a voicemail, which wasn't pleasant. It was kind of ugly. And so I ended up getting fired from my ex-therapist. And then she proceeded to take me to court and make false accusations about everything that was going on. She gaslit and manipulated and misrepresented and presented misinformation and whatnot to authorities who had me charged with criminal harassment, and as well as had charged with uttering threats. And so basically, thank you, Doug Ford, for your commentary. I was able to use one of his sound bites to actually get one of my charges dropped, which is the other threats. So that got dropped, and then it was really just about criminal harassment. But what I find really interesting about the entire legal process was I had an 8-page medical doctor's report presented to the Crown Attorney about my illnesses, about my diagnosis, about all the symptoms. I had a 30-page psychiatric assessment presented to the court by a forensic psychiatrist and a few other medical professionals, presented documentation to the courts, all saying that, you know, all in support of mental health diversion. And it comes down to only the Crown Attorney has the ability to make a determination whether it's a criminal case or if it's going to have mental health diversion. And so the female Crown Attorney that had, well, I say she ignored all my documentation, but they say that they rejected it. And of course, you know, when I asked after my whole court case, I asked for, you know, supporting documentation, if she was qualified to actually read this documentation, actually the decision, and I was basically told that the courts are not accountable to the people, or the Attorney General is not accountable to the people, they're accountable to the courts. So there was no obligation for them to give me any of the information, even though as a taxpayer, you know, they work for us. And yet I was told flat out that we disagree, and that was the end of that. So needless to say, I ended up, apparently I ended up pleading guilty to the criminal harassment, even though I don't remember being there, I don't remember being arrested. A lot of it has to do with my diagnosis of social identity disorder. It's well documented, but the courts ignored it all. So that's how we got to this particular point in my life. And then I should say that all happened from 2016 until present day, because I'm still working with the Information Privacy Commission and a few other tribunals to get my health records from my ex-therapist, who refuses to hand them over and is holding them hostage for the last 5 years. And, of course, to make the situation even more interesting is she actually retired last year from July last year. She retired from being a psychotherapist in Ontario. Mm-hmm. She moved out of our province. And then in August of last year, she applied, there's legislation called PIFA. I can't remember what that acronym means.
I know what you're talking about. I don't remember either. Yeah.
Yeah. But so what she keeps throwing out is PIFA section 52, EI, saying that, that I'm a risk of self-harm and harm to others. And, that's her argument, and that's what she keeps throwing out there. And what's really interesting about that is she applied that again last August, 5 years after she last saw me in clinical session, hasn't spoken to me since, and yet the Information Privacy Commission, everyone keeps buying the fact that this law can be applied. And when I asked where's the supporting documentation, the IPC told me that it was up to me so it was up to me anyways to prove the application of this law to be incorrect. And when I told the IPC, no, it's up to you to actually make whoever invoking that law to provide supporting documentation that's actually current and relevant, it's up to you to actually make them produce that documentation. And the IPC told me that if I don't like the law, take it up with the politicians. The law is law.
Wow.
So that's where I'm at these days. That's where I'm at these days. So, you know, everyone, they deem me dangerous. They deem me, I've been vilified and demonized. I've been mentally ill and shamed into oblivion. I also want to mention that CMHA, WW, in my own community, because I'm in Wardley, Wellington, I will tell you that, I'm Fishburne, who's CEO, and I'll say the name because I don't care anymore. I really don't. What can they do to me anymore? I look at it and that person, incompetent, shouldn't have that role at all. I'll put some context around this for you. When they banned me the first time several years ago, they banned me. They didn't give me, a risk of self-harm and a risk of harming others. They deemed me dangerous. And yet when they banned me the first time, they didn't give me any supporting numbers. And they didn't even do a client safety risk assessment, even though they deemed me dangerous, and left me with devices. I woke up in the middle of the night for 3 weeks there, and I tried to put power tools through my head. To me, that's criminal negligence. And because I'm already deemed a criminal, this is how corrupt everything is. Even when I go to the police, or if I go to the court system and I file my complaint, no one does anything about it. That doesn't qualify, or no one wants to go after CMHA. CMHA seems to be the holy grail of irresponsible organizations. And I just want to tell the public that CMHA is not who you think they are.
Now that's quite an ordeal you've been through. So, with all this talk leading up to now, I couldn't imagine what's going through your head with all this. It's basically so discouraging. Here you are, you're trying to help yourself, and then you're getting smacked in the head, saying, no, you can't do that. It's not within you to do that, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever. I'm curious. So have you been able to, I guess you really haven't found anybody that you really talk to that's on your side, in regards as far as lawyers are concerned, as an example, or somebody with some kind of a mental health judicial experience that could help you with this in a non-partisan way that would help you. But that's like almost what you need, somebody who really knows about this stuff that could help you, which is not biased.
Yeah, Stuart, it's kind of interesting. I'm on to different lawyers, different websites. I think the unicorn here is lawyers who do pro bono work.
Mm-hmm.
That's got to be the biggest unicorn that I'm aware of, because I've gone to all kinds of different had all kinds of different come up with law firms, and it's either they don't want to take my case on because it's too complicated.
It sounds too
difficult. Or if they do want to take my case on, they want me to mortgage my house for a retainer.
Wow, that's crazy. That's crazy. Because a lot of it, you know, to me, it sounds like it's just basic human rights, which they don't seem to be following. It's not for me to express an opinion, because it's not for me to have an opinion, really, to be honest with you, because it's who you're dealing with. But still, it's really, really unfair, unjust, and it's pretty apparent. I mean, you can see it.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and throughout this entire process, Stuart, you know, my charter rights have been completely violated, especially in the court of law, you know, and because of my mental illnesses, you know, by the time I came to realize what actually happened, because I actually had to rely on court transcripts in other tribunals that my ex-therapist lawyer printed off so that I could read them to figure out what actually happened in court, because I wasn't, you know, this version of conscious self, I wasn't there. You know, and the courts claim I was there. Everyone claims that Victor was in the building. But you know what? The body was there, but the mind wasn't. And yet they all deny that. You know, they all say, oh, we got her, man. You know, they take their trophy. They hoist it up as high as they can, and they tell the whole world, you know, that they got their man, that you know, Victor is, you know, he was sentenced. He you know, and then of course, according to the court transcripts, the judge and everyone's patting me on the back, saying, "Good for you for taking accountability for you know what you did." And you know, when I read it, it's like I wasn't even there. So I mean, you know, how ignorant and arrogant can you be to not even cover your bases? And yet I can't even get anyone to help me out because my charter rights were violated. It was a farce. It was a fiasco. I don't know where you know what else to say about it. But now, you know, all they've done is they lit a fire in my belly. You know, I'm not going to be nice about it because I've been in this fight way too long. And I'm looking out for people like you and I, people with lived experience, to ensure that you know, they're looked after, that they're actually protected. Because everything I've been through, the government says that there are safeguards put in place to reduce the risk of harm to people with living experience. Well, I can tell you from my experience is every one of those safeguards, it's all about protecting the politicians. It's all about protecting the professions.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with us.
Yeah, it's about protecting the system. So from all this time to now, like what you've been dealing with, like, so what's it been like just with you? Like, I mean, what kind of stuff's going through your head, like through all this? I mean, I know you're discouraged and pissed off. Anybody would be, absolutely. And you have every right to be. But, like, how is it day-to-day for you most days?
Well, that's an interesting animal because, so I'll tell you what it's like for day to day. So I'll tell you what my for the last year and a half or so, what my day really consists of. I wake up and what happens is, you know, like I can start my day, but a lot of times when I wake up, the first thought that enters my mind is one of these, it puts me in a place where it's like, well, you know, I don't want to die, but I don't want to live either.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's where my mind is always at. And then from there, you know, I'll do my day job. I compartmentalize a lot of the mental or the trauma mind. I compartmentalize the trauma mind. I shut it down or I push it out of the way and mm-hmm. ignore it, which is not ideal. And then usually on lunchtime when I take my lunch break, that's usually when I get my first brain attack. That's what I refer to as brain attacks. And to put it into context, some people have heart attacks. I have brain attacks, and they're brutal. Usually around lunch, I'm probably crawling under my desk, curled up in a ball, crying, not knowing who's going to hurt me next. Thinking to myself, I don't want to hurt anymore. You know, that, and then I have a crisis line, St. Leonard Society, I just want to put that out there. I'm going to give them a plug because they're an organization like no other. They're not CMHA, not the least bit. These guys out of Brantford, they're top-notch. Their leadership is top-notch. There's a willingness and there's a receptivity for dialogue and conversation so that people with living experience have the ability to be understood so they can understand and we can be understood. So it's a great organization. But so if to go back to my day, so I end up, you know, crawling the crisis line over my lunch hour. They get me into a place that encourages me to get myself out from under my desk. So I get myself out from under my desk. I go back to work. I do my job. And then usually at the end of the day, I usually have another brain attack, just with my anxiety issues. But what really gets interesting is at nighttime, I go through, for the last year and a half, I go through what I describe as atomization of self. And that is, I get completely dismantled mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually, and with living flashbacks. So what happens, and is predominantly all my suicide attempts, my death experience, I get to relive that almost every night for 2 hours. It's like, you know, when you get those phantom pains in your body, you're like, why does that hurt all of a sudden? Yeah. Well, I get it all. I get, like, from all my experiences, every aspect, and I can tell you that dying is one thing, experiencing that precise moment where the body separates from the soul is painful as hell. But I tell you that we're not designed to go the other way, where the body reunites with the soul. But that is even more painful. So I go through that process. Once that spits me out, because once I go through that process, I can't even tell you what reality is anymore, because all your senses get turned inside out, twisted upside down. It's very strange where I'll have hands on the carpet. I'll be laying, like, on my stomach on my carpet in my bedroom, and I can feel ever so slightly maybe the texture of the carpet, but the skin feels like it's on fire, or it's really cold, or it feels like it's in water. But then on the top of my hand, whatever I'm feeling in the bottom of my hand, the top of my hand, I have the complete opposite. So if my bottom of my hand is experiencing the fire instinct, then the top of my hand usually feels the water when I drown in the pool. These where I taste dirt, or I taste chlorine, or I smell chlorine, and nothing is linear. Like, that's the thing. There's no rhyme or reason. It's just, you're just flooded with these intense sensations everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so that goes on for about 2 hours. Once I get through that, then I get the opportunity to, and the privilege to relearn how to use my arms and legs. Because somewhere along the process of going through that episode, my brain gets so mangled and disrupted that I can't access information that knows how to use my arms and legs. And so it takes about 30 minutes to 45 minutes for me to actually learn how to walk again and use my arms and legs. And then once I get through that, then I go into my sleep my bed, and then I have terrible anxiety attacks now, especially in the last month or so. 2 months has been very intense. I have these crazy anxiety attacks as soon as I close my eyes, because here's why the anxiety attacks exist, is because, like clockwork, I have night terrors every night, and those night terrors consist, and they're gory as hell. It's bad. It's really, really bad. That's all I can say about that. But I tell you that those night terrors, it's usually the same. It's the same theme. My circle, my current circle of care, they're all frozen, standing up, and they can't talk, but they can mouth words. And so all they keep mouthing is, "I'm sorry." Meanwhile, I'm getting completely maimed, tortured, and ripped apart. And then eventually I get a couple bullets to the head in my night terror that you know, kill that entity in that night terror. But that's when I wake up. But what happens is all the sensations in my night terror manifest themselves into the physical conscious stream. So when I wake up, I'm waking up in all the sensations of that night terror. That's pretty much how my days work.
Mm. Wow, that's pretty wild. I really want to thank you for sharing your story. That's really, really important, and what you've been through, and especially this part. Like, I mean, daily life dealing with this, it can't be easy. So, like, for example, your experience you just talked about with your night terrors and you leaving your body like that. So by lying down and kind of take us through that a little bit and how you make that connection with your body again so you can actually start moving your arms, your legs. Talk a little more about that if you wouldn't mind.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's basically...
Great example of disassociation is what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, so when that happens, like, well, no, so those are nightly episodes. So they're separate than the night terror. The night terror happens after the nightly episode. So the nightly episode is where I get completely dismantled. And it's interesting because, you know, like I said, it's been over a year and a half now. I can see it coming. You know, the mental health experts say that, you know, people have choices and people have control. Well, I'm going to tell you that's bullshit because when I go through what I go through, there is no choice. There is no control. There's no way to stop it. There's no way to get out of it. You know, once it grabs a hold of you, it's got you, and it's going to do what it's going to do, and it's going to spit you out when it's finished. So when I get spit out the other side, you know, I'm physically exhausted. I'm mentally exhausted. I can tell you that, you know, this version of conscious self, the sliver that's left over, all I can do is retreat inward and just be an observer and watch everything unfold around me. Or a lot of times I spend time reflecting on everything I've been through, and I get, you know, quite philosophical. But when I get to the other side, it you know, at first it was terrifying, because I didn't know if I was completely broken. You know, when you lose your ability to move your arms and legs, and you know, you're consciously aware that you're trying to move your limbs and they're not moving. You know, that freaked me out for the first little while. You know, I didn't know if I was paralyzed. I didn't know what was going on. And then all of a sudden, you know, you get a little flop here and a little flick there and a little tremor. And so you just start focusing on that. And then, you know, it doesn't take long. It doesn't take long to reestablish those pathways in the brain where that information is. And then, you know, it's like, the only way I can describe it is there's lots of videos online about this. Where it's I believe it's an impala and a leopard in Africa, and they show you you know what happens. You know, the impala will play dead, will shut down its whole nervous system, go through a complete shutdown, where the predator thinks this animal is actually completely dead, and so it might, you know, take it, drag it somewhere safe, and then it might get up and go away and you know, do something that it needs to do. In the meantime, that impala is you know, waking up, coming back, and eventually gets up, and it's really shaky and whatnot, but eventually gets up and walks away from that situation. I go, you know, it's basically the same thing. You know, I go through and you know, it's shaky. You know, the arm shakes. You know, like I said, it takes about a half hour, 45 minutes. The arms are the first thing that come in the play, and it doesn't take that long for the arms to get back into 100% functionality. It's the legs and the balance, learning how to balance, rebalance yourself. You know, and it's funny. I mean, I kind of keep a sense of humor about this, but I look at it this way. It's a good thing that, you know, you learn how to walk when you're a kid, because as an adult, when your legs give out and you collapse to the floor, it's a long way down, and it hurts like hell when you hit the floor. As a child, I mean, you're that much closer to the ground, so gravity doesn't have that much of an impact.
So over this time now, with your you have a really good sense of awareness of what's going on in your body. So as time has moved on to like to today, that sense of awareness must have grown exponentially in regards to what you feel and think in your body. Is that the case?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, it's interesting because I look at it as there's really three things that I think have really helped me, and that is one of the therapies that I did was called the prolonged exposure therapy, or PE. It's also known as PE or PEP, depending on who you speak to. And now that therapy is not for everyone. And for your viewers out there, your listeners, if you're thinking about prolonged exposure therapy, you need to know that you're walking into the devil's lair. The whole premise behind that modality is you're taking trauma head on. You need to relive everything. And of course you're dealing with a practitioner who can walk you through. But you'll get triggered. It's soul destroying. But at the same time, once you get through it. The whole premise of that modality is to desensitize you from your past trauma or whatever happened. And there's a few things that's worked on. Like I used to have abandonment issues. My prolonged exposure really dealt with that. I used to have issues speaking about the knife incident with my mother. It took like 6-7 weeks, I think, of prolonged exposure therapy. And it dealt with that. That I can speak about it. There's a couple other ones I'm working on, but that was one of them. The other therapy that I highly suggest or have people look into, and that's equine therapy, horse therapy.
Mm-hmm.
But I want the caveat around that. There's two trains of thought behind equine therapy. And now maybe I'm jaded because my ex-therapist is also, the equine world put her on a goddamn pedestal saying that she's like the expert psychotherapist with equine work. And it's actually pretty disgusting and irresponsible on how the industry does what it does. But that's a story for another time. But what I can tell you is, so her whole thing is, The one world of equine therapy is driven a lot by self-therapy and psychotherapists working with horses and doing equine work. But what they do is they tell you that they can help the horse by doing like touch work, like somatic experience work mm-hmm. with the horse. They can work with the horse to resolve trauma within the horse. And this is why I question this whole process is because when you look at it, horses have been around long before humans.
Mm-hmm.
What makes horses really interesting, what makes equine therapy really interesting, is that horses can resolve their own nervous system quite quickly and efficiently. So my perspective is all of a sudden when I look at it is when I look at the psychotherapist. Doing equine work and promoting somatic experience with working with horses because they do focus on the horse in that camp as well as the human. But I look at it and go, I don't think you're really doing anything for the horse if you're doing touch work with a horse because horses already know how to resolve nervous system issues. So there's no value in that. You're just trying to sell the value to the Luddites of the world who aren't familiar with how equine therapy works. Now, the other side of this coin is equine assisted learning, which is what I take part in. And that is, I have a coach. I work with horses all the time. And it's really about establishing and understanding your relationship with self, mm-hmm. your relationship with the horse, mm-hmm. your relationship with self, the horse, and your environment, your relationship with everyone around you. And so at the end of the day, it's really about existing or quote unquote being in the moment with horses. And I find that, if I go in, if I go there, when I'm at my horse, when I'm at the horse farm, I realize that that's the only place where the nightmare of my mental illnesses can't touch me.
I can really appreciate that. And it's been last year that I've actually, myself, I can kind of appreciate talking about with equine therapy because I've started that myself. I'm hoping to be a facilitator of that someday, which I'm sure that's going to happen, but it's going to take some time. But I've got an experience under my belt, not just taking a horse home for my roads, but being around the horses. And lucky for me, I grew up around them, so I kind of have an idea. But I didn't really understand and respect until I got to that point, which you're talking about, where, you know, I've been around horses, but I didn't realize how sensitive they are and how they are sensitive towards humans and how they pick up emotion and they show you. It's so incredible. And I love that you're talking about this, too, because this is another great form of therapy to help find yourself. Because if you can't, I know I had trouble finding myself when I started off dealing with my CSA. And now I found another realm to help find myself. And horses is just incredible, right? It's like, I mean, even on the weekend I was working with them. And every time I go there, I discover something new about myself I didn't know about myself. So, you know, and they tell me, and I didn't even know it. So it's pretty incredible. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. So what I can tell you, like, I mean, when I first started, and I don't know, people who follow me, they'll know the horses that I'm talking about. So the one horse that I work with predominantly, his name is Theo. He's a big old Clydesdale, mm-hmm. black and white.
Gentle giant.
Oh yeah, and you know, he didn't grow up on a horse farm. I don't know what kind of farm he grew up on, but it wasn't a horse farm. So he doesn't even think of himself as a horse for half the time. But when I first started working with him a couple of years ago, because horses reflect back what they're sensing from your emotion, your nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
And my nervous system was so fried that Theo used to bite my arm all the time, and he would not only just bite it, but he would clamp onto it and keep as much pressure on my arm as possible. Not to the point where he broke the skin, but he broke a lot of, you know, I got severe bruising, mm-hmm. blood vessels. But it wasn't because he was trying to harm me. It was because he was trying to settle my nervous system. And that's what they do. And so over the years working with them, it's just, you know, you start to realize like how much I've grown just understanding myself by working with a horse, because I mean the horse reflects what you are presenting, mm-hmm. internally, mm-hmm. And because of the world that we live in and because of digital media and just society in general, multi-generational society, is that we're so disconnected from ourselves, and we're so disconnected from our food sources, we're so disconnected from everything in the world, that we don't even know how to reconnect ourselves. We can talk about it, everyone talks about it, but at the end of the day, no one really knows how to connect themselves to the world around them. And it's interesting because the other part of the conversation I wanted to touch upon was, so my current therapist is a medical doctor first, and then specializes in psychotherapy. He's very unorthodox, brilliant man. He's got a lot of experience from around the world that, from spending time in Japan as a child, as well as dealing with pygmy tribes, I think, in Africa. But he's just a wealth of knowledge. And so working with him has been a godsend because he's the last, his last defense is to get his script out and run something it down and tell you to go to the pharmacy. That's not the fan. He will not go there. You know, you can beg and plead. He won't go there if he doesn't have to. And so what he's done for me is he recommended a bunch of books for me to read because I have one of my identities. There's about 20 identities in me. So in this conversation, I just want to put some context around. We're not alone. Yeah, I mean, you might see just me, but there's 19 other people involved in this conversation or aware of this conversation. But what's interesting is, he's recommended a couple books for me to read, and one is which I never realized would have such a profound impact on me. It's called Lane Deer: Memoirs of a Sioux Medicine Man, and it talks about and he's a real person. It talks about his life. Talks about everything that he goes through, and you know, talks about the process of the Sundance Festival that they go through. So there's a lot of things that I do now as I look at what I'm doing is this is my Sundance, this is my rite of passage. And then the other book I'm reading, I have this over here. Let me just get the title for you. It's called Sand Talk: How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World by Tyson Yunkaporta. Fascinating book. You know, and a lot of the books that I am reading have a lot to do with indigenous teachings, knowledge, and you know, it's made me really think, and it's made me get really philosophical about my approach to the world. Because one of the things that, you know, I grew up probably like you, Stuart. I grew up in you know, an era where, you know, we had these phenomenal athletes, like from Muhammad Ali to Bruce Lee.
Yeah, Bruce Lee.
Bruce Lee. Yeah. And so, you know, I remember the series Kung Fu, and I remember, you know, I was always fascinated with the martial arts. And so I remember years ago hearing Bruce Lee talk about being like water, being shapeless, colorless, formless, and just being fluid. And what I learned in the last year and a half, going through my nightly episodes, is just that. Is when you start thinking about the essence of life, the strongest element on this planet is water. We can't stop it. We can't do anything. And then water is also a shapeshifter. So when you start thinking about yourself as being water, a lot of people commend me for my strength, don't understand don't understand where my strength comes from. Neither do I, to be quite honest. But I used to think, you know, for years I used to think I had to be a rock. I had to be solid. I had to be, you know, nothing can break a rock. And that's where most of us are incorrect. As men, we're always told to be, we got to be strong like rocks. We got to be, you know, stoic. Ever since I've taken on this whole philosophy of water, when you really start to think about it, and when you really start to get cerebral about it and look at the readings of the indigenous communities and their philosophies, you know, they talk about an endless circle as part of their life cycle. And when you start thinking about that, and then when you start thinking about, you take that and that, just that concept alone, and you start thinking about water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, water is the endless circle. And so that's what helps me get through my episodes is that I have to look at it as I need to be fluid, because if you really look at the essence of life, stagnant water is dead water. When water is still, life doesn't exist. And so from that perspective, I worked a lot on trying to reinforce within me that that I'm water and that I need to be fluid and need to move and flow and being able to surround, embrace, caress the nightmare that I'm in, my symptoms, dance with the devil, because if you're water, it's a lot easier to be fluid and dance with the devil than it is to be a rock and weigh the devil down. Or the other way around, the devil weighs you down. And so, you know, and I don't know if that, you know, this is quite conceptual. It's quite philosophical.
Great analogy, though.
Yeah, especially on a Wednesday afternoon.
Yeah,
but exactly. That's what helped me get through a lot of the shit that I go through. You know, and then it's really interesting because the other thing that I picked up out of this book, Sand Talk, is it talks about how we're all equal. Every being, every human being is equal. No one is greater than another, and that we should be able to hold. We must be able to hold opposition, space for opposition, and being able to process it and understand so that others can be understood. And so I've been working really hard on learning that and trying to ensure that I don't put myself in a position of coming across as being greater than another individual. Because at the end of the day, you and I are basically the same, same as well as the health efforts, as well as the therapist is on my emphasis and series. We're all the same, all equal. And I look at the mental health sector, and I preach the same thing to them, but, you know, because of their, all their years of schooling, I guess all those degrees of arrogance and ignorance, the cheap wall art they overpaid for, that gives them the right in their minds to position themselves and point the finger at people with lived experience and tell us that they can fix us. And that's the other thing too, right? There is no fix. It's all about managing expectations.
Yeah, exactly.
And learning self and learning how to move around sometimes I think what I have are gifts, and sometimes I think what I have is a curse. But today is gift day, so I'll look at it. Well, I should say it's a gift moment. So I'll look at it this way. I mean, I learned how to dance with my gifts and you know, try to move forward and whatnot. So, but it's an interesting animal. It really is, Stuart. And it's a meat grinder. It's a meat grinder. There's a few people who told me that, mental health takes about, mental illness, shaves about 10 to 20 years off your lifespan, on average. That's just one of the stats that's out there. And it's funny because, I'm a 50-year-old man. I look at what I go through every night and what I've gone through for the last 7 years. I'm an ex-smoker. I've been, six, seven weeks now without tobacco. And it's interesting because, I look at it and I go, So right off the bat, there's 30 years potentially caved off my life. So, I do the reverse math and I think to myself, so how much time do I have left? But then at the same time, to put that in the context, I also have these identities in me that can check this version of conscious self out at any time, any moment. Mm-hmm. And check themselves in, and they'll do whatever they want to this body. I've come up the other side with broken bones. I know that if they wanted to, they can kill me. They can kill me in an instant. I just have to live with that.
I really, really appreciate your saying. And you know what? A lot of what we do, trying to find ourselves is, after we've been, especially since we've been in in our own hell for as long as we can remember, and then just to change ourselves around like that, it's just never that easy of a concept. It doesn't help for men either that we grew up with the conception of that we're supposed to be, not say anything, hide our pain and life goes on. But lo and behold, from my experience and obviously from yours as well and many others that I've heard, this is really not the case. You know, we can go all these years and all these years and hide and hide and hide, hide our pain and emotion. And then something happens then where we show our pain and anguish. And, you know, right away we're slapped with, well, you know, you can't do that. And, you know, it's just not humane or whatever you person may do that society may not agree with what you've done. And, okay, of course, right off the bat, well, we're an adult now. So therefore, there's no excuses for us showing our pain from our past. But yet, humans do that, whether it's male or female. It makes no difference. We have to show our pain somehow, whether it's through addictions, whether it's through standing in a corner street and yelling at the top of our head and saying what's on our mind. And, you know, a lot of times, by doing so, most people just ignore us and say, well, you know what, she's just a, well, if I can quote what other people would say, they say you're just a whack job or you've lost something. But really, people need to change. And I'm hoping that this pandemic is part of this change, this so-called reset. If I could use that terminology, which I hate that because it's a government thing, and it is a reset in itself, I guess, in a sense, but bullshit nonetheless. But I'm not here to talk about the reset. But this is what's happening. And men like you and myself are very, are you know, I'm being gentle with my language now, but we're really effing fed up with this. We need a place to talk where there's no judgment. You know, what you've been through with your court and mental health and trying to help yourself, being slapped in the face for, is really, really discouraging. And through this whole pandemic, now you're going back to the pandemic again, but through this whole pandemic, now, if you check statistics, you will find that men overall as a whole, we've shut down more than we have prior to this pandemic. Now, who would have figured that? Well, that's really the case of what's going on. And you're not going to see many statistics about this. But what I've seen and talking, I've been watching and seeing what's going on. Well, are men actually coming forward more? No, we're not. Not through this last year and a half or almost 2 years. We haven't. If anything, we stepped back. I have seen some instances where we have said that. Go ahead.
I just want to say, Stuart, like when it comes to men, and you know, I've seen the same statistic. We have gone backwards in sharing and dealing with our mental illness and in our challenges. But I think part of the issue is first of all, you know, the mental health sector uses the term safe and safety. And also weaponizes it as well, and you know, against people with lived experience. And so when I look at that, I mean, that's the first thing that you know, I have always had difficulties with because I've never experienced a safe what safety is. I don't know what it is. You know, and my tolerances for safety are well outside the tolerances of most people who think that they're safe. And I'll give you an example. In order for me to survive all the years that I was abused by my family of origin, you know, whatever weapon they used to hurt me, I would give them a night, and I would you know, take those weapons and use them against myself so that I could absorb more pain than they could dish out. And so I used to do like 50 shots each side of my ribs as hard as I could, you know, and with any weapon. Baseball bats, frying pans, cords, you name it, whips, you name it, I was doing it. And so what I found was because of that, you know, everyone uses that word. Well, men don't really relate to the word safety. It's kind of like I'll use this analogy. It's kind of like giving a guy a model car, for example, and saying, here are the instructions. What guy actually reads the instructions for the most part? They'll briefly just skim it over and go, okay, I can tell by the pictures what goes where. And then, you know, they're on. And I think the same is true about, you know, when it comes to safety, like what guy really wants to talk about being safe? Like, you know, every guy likes, you know, we're all a little bit, know, we all have a little bit of bravado in us, and mm-hmm. you know, if one guy's going to do something, we're like, oh, I can do that. I can do that 10 times better than you can. You know, and then there's always that friendly competition. And the same holds true in you know, with mental illness, is that I don't think, I think predominantly one of the other issues is, you know, some of the vocabulary that's used. And the other predominant issue is if you look at the mental health business model and sector, there's more women than there are men, you know, as clinicians. And then there are more individuals within the mental health system that lack lived experience. And when I say lived experience, I mean there's different, you know, and this is a topic for another day, but there should be a different categorization of people with lived experience.
Trauma informed.
Because, because I mean, you know, and I'm offering apologies, this is my perspective on how I see the world. You know, everyone who tweets and says, oh, I got stressed, anxiety, depression because of COVID. You know what? That could be valid. That is absolutely valid. But at the same time, for someone like me, that's below child's play. You know, on how to deal with it. And so, from that perspective, when you really start to think on how men interact with a system, you know, most men want to hear from people who lived it. And not read about it in a book.
Absolutely. And, you know, and this has been one of my greatest privileges is by going to the gatehouse. We talk about safe places. Well, this was my safe place because here I am, a 60-year-old male, and 10 years ago, I had nothing. There was nothing. There was places, but when you talk about safety, I didn't trust anybody because I've been had so many times. I just, like, bought a trust. Not had by medical people, right? And did not see any kind of light at all. So me going there was a big thing for me. So for talking about men finding safety, this is where I was really, really fortunate to get this. And to this day, I'll ever be grateful. I mean, as long as I live, I'll always remember that safety you're talking about, because I never had it any other place I went looking for that safety where I can actually talk about it and not worry about anything could happen, like whether it be verbally, physically, whatever, right?
Yeah.
It took me years.
Yeah, and Stuart, to that point, I mean, the only place where I feel protected or I have any type of security is when I'm on the farm.
Yeah, the horses, yeah.
I mean, with the horses, because I know that the herd has accepted me unconditionally, the entire herd.
Mm.
They don't care about the criminal. They don't care about the baggage. They care about my health, and they care about my well-being. And, you know, even though we don't speak the same language, our nervous systems do. And, you know, we can pick up on energy. And, you know, that is probably the closest thing I have to what, you know, what most people call the safe or safety. Because, you know, like I said, I can't relate to that term. But what I find really interesting is, you know, that's the vocabulary that's being used. And I think if there's vocabulary that was changed, and you know, you get more men speaking about mental well-being and mental illness. And just so you've seen some of my previous podcasts. I'm really intentional with some of the words I use. I tend to refer to mental health at all, because from my perspective, that's a business model. You know, it comes down to mental well-being, which is the state of the human condition,
mm-hmm.
and then mental illness, which is the injury to the body. So I try to keep that clear distinction, you know, when I speak about mental illness and my mental health system reform, mm-hmm. just to put some context around the conversation. I don't know if I said that or not, but just want to make sure that we're out there.
And thank you for saying so. We are coming close to our time. First, I want to tell you that our ED, I don't know if you saw that on the chat side, but our ED, our executive director, thanking you for sharing your story from the gatehouse. That's Maria Barcelosa. She just thanked you for sharing your story, and as I am too now, But is there anything you want to tell the men out there, or anybody in general, before we get off?
Well, first of all, you can look me up on Twitter. That Victor Jansen, all one word, because I have an open DM. So, any men that out there that want support, need to talk to somebody, I can listen. I can give you some suggestions, and so forth. And just to realize that, when it comes to mental illnesses, there are no fixes. Any practitioner who says they can fix you, my suggestion at that point is to politely decline and turn around and walk out, because don't waste your time with that individual. And lastly, I think the biggest thing that I think that really needs to be addressed in mental health business model is, I think, from a leadership standpoint, I think it's important that, you do have the academic leadership put in place, but I think it should be a co-leadership. So you have a CEO who's there based on education, but then you also have a co-CEO who's there based on lived experience, because they're two different animals. They're two sides of the same coin, and right now there's such an imbalance of power in the mental health sector in favor of clinicians and administrators and the like. To be quite honest, they're missing the mark, and I find it intriguing now how there's a lot of them tapping me on the shoulder, want to talk to me about my living experience. I don't mind talking about it, and I think it's great, and I think it's progressive, but I think it's a little fish with this pandemic. Conversation should have been happening, 2 years ago, and now we're playing catch up. And so one of the biggest things that I'm trying to do with my advocacy work and my activism, is really to try to work with leaders within the mental health community, the ones that, and I should put a caveat onto that, the ones that actually want to talk to me, because there's a lot that don't want to talk to me because of my polarizing commentary, and I find that a lot have issues because I don't apologize for anything I say, because I lived it, and so you're not going to get an apology out of me. So I find it really interesting that, these individuals do want, there are some great leaders and they know who they are. I don't know if I can say anything. But all my supporters, they know who they are and they know what my intentions are. It's one of these things where I'm working with them has given the hopeless, me, a opportunity to perhaps reinvest in the construct of hope. So that's my suggestion. What I look at, and for most men, call this rude, call this disrespectful. I'm just getting to the point. Get your head out of your ass, give it a shake, and actually talk about your mental illness. Because it's not going to go away, and it will eat you alive.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you. Thank you ever so much, Victor. Victor Jansen has been my guest today. You'll find him on Twitter, as he just pointed out. Victor has talked about some really deep-seated issues today about stuff that, his experience, obviously, but, and it should not be taken lightly in any way whatsoever. If you could be having issues, it's very same as Victor right now, and not knowing which way to turn or who to talk to. But I would tell you this, and obviously I'm not going to tell you what to do because I'm not here to tell you what to do, but if you are a man or a woman and you are seeking help, one of the biggest things I always tell them is that if you're seeking help and And it's so very important, you know, understanding what kind of help you need. It's to start off with. And then doing your research and finding the right person to help you is so important, because I've heard this, seen this on social media so many times. When you're seeking help and you meet up with somebody and you think you have the right person, then 2 weeks later down the line, or two sessions in later, there's no connection there, and therefore it was a waste of your time and their time. So when seeking help, I really recommend that you do your research, one, with the person you're going to be doing with, and more importantly, what are your needs? What do you need for that person to do to help you through your process of what you're trying to get through? So keeping these things in mind are very, very important when you're out there seeking help. And, you know, that's about already all I can say to this, is that, you know, from my past experience and what you've heard from Victor, you're not, I mean, obviously, even when I went and sought help, there was no way of seeking, or rather, no way of researching it to the way there is nowadays. At least you got the internet. You can look people up. You can find people. You know, people write reviews on people. There's all kinds of ways of finding out stuff about the individual you're going to go and see. So do your research, because at the end of the day, you know, not only are you paying this person to help you, but or whoever means you're doing it to for this person to do it, but you need to think about what you need. Because if you don't know what you need, then how's that person going to help you? So folks, pay close attention to that. This is what I would recommend anyway. And obviously, I'm not here to tell you what to do, but that's what I would recommend you do. Victor, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on here today. Maybe we can get you on again before the year is out. It would be greatly appreciated. Maybe you'll have some things, absolutely, new things to tell us. And it's been a strange year, and I know there's lots going to happen between now and fall. I would imagine so with the world, or at least our part of the world anyway right now, as things start to open up and hopefully things start to change, hopefully for somewhat to the better. Folks, we're approaching Canada Day, which is tomorrow. I noticed how I said Canada, not Canada. Here I'm getting mixed up. But anyway, tomorrow's Canada Day, day off, long weekend for some. But anyway, folks, take care of yourselves. Thank you for watching Personal Transformation. Thank you, Victor. And
many blessings.
I'm just gonna do just this. Oh, too many buttons here. And if I lose you, Victor, take care.
All right, thank you.
Thanks again. Actually, I didn't lose you.
Me. I'm still here.
Yeah, I didn't lose you. I wasn't sure if I was gonna lose you or not, but I.